We're in chapter 12 of the book of Revelation. I'm hoping we'll make it through the end of chapter 12 today. Then we're going to slow down a little bit. I think we're probably going to have an entire class just on the first two verses of chapter 13. But that will probably be next week. If you look at your handout, I think you'll find something interesting there. I did. I looked this week for some material for the class and was found myself looking for some coins that were minted at that time. And I really ended up looking at that all week, looking for various coins and things, and found it a very interesting study to look at the coins, the historical nature of the coins, and what they tell us about the book of Revelation. We've already looked at one coin earlier when we saw Rome, the goddess Roma, sitting upon seven hills. And then we talked about how this book is about Rome and how that parallels some of the descriptions of Rome that are in the book of Revelation. I think these coins may even be more interesting for our study, the ones on the handout, which I hope everyone has a copy of that. This handout this week shows two coins that were minted during the reign of Domitian, who, as you know from our other classes, is someone I believe is a focus of the book of Revelation, the emperor Domitian. Now, no one doubts that Nero persecuted Christians, but there are a few who doubt that Domitian ever persecuted Christians. And we're going to consider that issue at length later. I believe what we'll find out is that the evidence suggests that he did persecute Christians, and he did persecute them quite a bit, although admittedly, the extra-biblical evidence for that is not as strong for Domitian as it is for Nero. Now, the handout shows some circumstantial evidence for Domitian's persecution of the church. On one coin, the one at the top, actually the one at the bottom, Domitian is referred to as Divi Filius. The Filius is just the F, abbreviation. That means son of the divine or son of God. That's what that means there at the bottom. On the other coin, the one at the top, it shows Domitian's young infant son, who apparently died in infancy. And that young son is referred to as the divine Caesar, son of the emperor Domitian. And the child, as you can see there, is sitting on a globe and stretches his hands out toward what? Seven stars. Seven stars. A divine child who holds seven stars in his hands. Where have we seen that before? Speaking of Christ, Revelation 1 verse 16 says, and he had in his right hand seven stars. The similarities here are just unmistakable. Domitian must have seen in Christianity a threat to his own claims of divinity, not just for himself, but for his own son. Remember what Paul said, I believe, about Domitian in 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 4. Who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he as God sitteth in the temple of God, showing himself that he is a God. Read that description and look at those coins. It's a very fascinating study to look at coins of that time and compare them to this book of Revelation. In chapter 12, a giant dragon waits to swallow up the Son of God. We know very little about Domitian's son, as I mentioned, except that he died in infancy. And when I saw that, it made me wonder who swallowed up whom. You know, we've been looking at these judgments against Rome and comparing them to the plagues against Egypt. Remember that last plague? Remember that last plague? Maybe Domitian experienced one of those Egyptian plagues literally. We'll have a lot more to say about Domitian as our study continues. Revelation chapter 12. Last time we were looking at verses 3 and 4 when we ended. In verse 4, we're told that the great red dragon stood before the woman, waiting to devour her child when it was born. To an outside observer, it must have looked like this child has no chance at all. How could anyone, much less a newborn baby, prevail against this mighty great dragon? I'm sure the great dragon had the exact same view. How could it possibly be defeated by a mere baby? It will just swallow it right up and that'll be the end of the story, right? Wrong. Things are not what they seem. Satan had once attempted to swallow up this child literally through Herod the Great. And of course, that was really through Rome, because Rome pulled Herod's strings. Now Satan was once again trying to do the same thing to the body of Christ, to his church, and once again through Rome. Satan knew he would never have a better opportunity than right now, attack the church in its infancy, when Satan had the mighty Roman Empire at his command, the greatest weapon he had ever had. Satan had been waiting to devour this child since Genesis chapter 3. Now was his chance. This devouring of God's people reminds us of Old Testament imagery. Once again, Jeremiah 51:34, Babylon swallows God's people like a monster, we're told. Egypt, in Ezekiel 29 verse 3, is described as a great dragon, the same symbol we see here. And Egypt, of course, tried to swallow up God's people. Egypt tried to swallow up the servant of God, Moses, as a child, as a baby. So again, there's a parallel. At the time of this book, the weapon had changed from Babylon, from Egypt, to Rome. But the person, the one wielding that weapon, Satan, had not changed. The same serpent we met in Genesis chapter 3. You know, Revelation is often viewed as a book that looks forward. But Revelation spends a whole lot of time looking backward, looking back across Old Testament history and applying that to Rome. Verse 5. She brought forth a male child, one who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. But her child was caught up to God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God in which to be nourished for 1,260 days. We find in these verses more evidence that Jesus is being shown here, that this child is Jesus. Verse 5 says the child was to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. We think of Psalm 2, verse 9. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron, speaking of Christ. Also recall Revelation 2, 26 and 27. He that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him I will give power over nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. Later in chapter 19, verse 15, we're going to read, and out of his mouth, Jesus, out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations. He shall rule them with a rod of iron. This child is Jesus. Before the dragon can devour him, though, the child is caught up to God and to his throne. Here we see the ascension of Christ back to his Father's throne in heaven. On this earth, he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. On this earth, he was tempted by Satan, yet without sin. On this earth, he was put to death by lawless hands, but he rose from the dead. He defeated Satan. He ascended back to heaven forever, out of Satan's grasp. It's a beautiful image. The birth in verse 5 likely involves much more than just the events in Bethlehem. The child that is born in verse 5 is the same child that is caught up to God in verse 5. The birth here, I think, covers the entire earthly ministry of Christ, from his birth all the way to his ascension in Acts chapter 1. Satan failed to defeat Jesus when he was most vulnerable, when he was made in the likeness of man, while he was found in the fashion as of a man, Philippians 2, 7 and 8. Satan certainly won't fare any better now that Jesus has gone back to the Father. He's ascended back into heaven. Before we even read further, we know what the message is about to be. We know what the message is going to be to the church. Just as these Christians had followed the example of Christ in their suffering, they would follow the example of Christ in ascending back to heaven, out of Satan's clutches, forever. They too would escape the clutches of this great dragon. Well, what happens next? Verse 6 tells us the woman flees into the wilderness. We're reminded of a lot of fleeing in the Bible. We're reminded of Moses fleeing from Pharaoh out into the wilderness. We're reminded of the Israelites fleeing Egypt out into the wilderness. We're reminded of Elijah fleeing Ahab and Jezebel out into the wilderness. We're reminded of Mary and Joseph fleeing Herod out into the wilderness. How long does it last? 1,260 days. That's 42 months. That's 3.5 years. That's a symbol we've seen so many times in our study of this book. This book is so beautiful when we understand the symbols. People who take each number literally, they're missing so much in this book. This book is so beautiful when we understand the symbols. The church is separated from Christ, yes, but for how long? 3.5 years. It's temporary. It's not permanent. It's not complete. It's temporary. The persecution was temporary, so is the separation. Although the woman flees to the wilderness, she finds there a place prepared by God. She's nourished. She's sustained there. God is assuring His people that although they're going to be persecuted by Rome, and that although Jesus is no longer with them in person, the situation will not last forever. But while it does, God will sustain them. He will protect them. He will nourish them. Once again, we're reminded of the Old Testament. Ezekiel 29, verse 3, which I referred to a moment ago, refers to Egypt as a great dragon. It says, "Speak and say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, the great dragon that liest in the midst of his rivers, which has said, my river is mine own, and I have made it for myself." That's speaking of Egypt. God's people in the Old Testament were also sustained, also nourished, also protected, in the wilderness, while running from a great dragon. That's the imagery that's being brought to mind here. For those keeping count, this is the third time and the third different way this same message has been delivered to the readers of this book to comfort them. First, they were told the city of God would be trampled underfoot for 3.5 years. Second, they were told two witnesses would prophesy for 3.5 years, then they would be killed by the beast, then after 3.5 days, they would rise. Third, where we are right now, this woman, forced to flee into the wilderness, 3.5 years, where she will find a place of nourishment and protection. Same message of comfort. This is now the third time. There will be yet another time, another way in which he tells us this. Verse 7. Now war arose in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought. But they were defeated, and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Is this a literal war in heaven? Two questions. How could it be? And why should it be? Satan was defeated at the cross. Recall John 12:31. Now shall the ruler of this world be cast out, Jesus said. Jesus does not need Michael to do what Jesus has already done himself. This battle, like the woman, like the child, like the dragon, is symbolic. It's figurative. Well, why show us this symbolic battle? Well, this battle and its outcome emphasize the point that Satan could not defeat Jesus while he was on earth. He's certainly not going to fare any better when Jesus is now up in heaven with God. He's not going to have a chance. And that's what these verses show us. He gets tossed out immediately. Is this scene some kind of a flashback, as we're sometimes told by the commentaries? That are we seeing here a description of Satan's actual fall sometime before the events in Genesis chapter 3? No. Look at the timing here. This is happening along with the ascension of Christ. This defeat is the defeat of Satan that Christ accomplished at the cross and at his resurrection and at his ascension. Well, was there really a war like this being fought at the cross? Absolutely there was. Yes, there was. And Jesus won that war. The Bible describes the victory of Christ as the outcome of a great conflict. Recall back in Isaiah 53, which we know describes the crucifixion, the death of Christ. What does it say in verse 12? Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great. He shall divide the spoil with the strong. That's what happens after a battle. Remember how Jesus described the conflict in Luke 11, 20 and 22, about the strong man coming in. Recall Jesus' statement in John 14, verse 30. For the prince of this world cometh and hath nothing in me, Jesus said. The outcome of that battle was never in doubt, but it was a battle. We also have our own great battles with Satan, don't we? And they also might not look like too much to others from the outside looking at it. But they're battles. They are battles. They are wars. We're also having a war with Satan. And the theme of this book is things are not always what they seem. Those Romans watching Jesus die on that cross, they didn't see a great battle at the time. But there was one going on. And it looked a lot like the one we're reading about here, figuratively. I think that's what we are reading about here. This great battle that Jesus won over Satan. No place is found in heaven for the dragon and his angels. But we're also told about another angel, Michael, who serves as Christ's representative here. He's named three times in the book of Daniel. There's so many links here back to the book of Daniel. Michael is one of the chief princes in Daniel 10:13. He's the prince of Israel in Daniel 10:21. In Daniel 12:1, Michael is called the great prince who stood for God's people, against the enemies of God's people. Michael is the picture in the Old Testament of the protector, someone who stands up for the people of God. Michael is the natural angel to come to defeat Satan here, to cast Satan out of heaven for Christ, Christ's representative. And he is cast out. Satan is cast out. No place is found in heaven for the dragon and for his angels. His assault on heaven is a complete failure. His defeat is decisive. When Jesus ascended, he had completely defeated Satan. And that's what the Bible tells us. 1 John 3:8, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. John tells us, the same John who's writing Revelation. John 16:11, the ruler of this world is judged. John 16:33, I have overcome the world. John 12:31, now the ruler of this world shall be cast out. Verse 9 refers to the dragon as the ancient serpent. Boy, we can't mistake that reference. That's taking us right back to Genesis chapter 3. It was through this serpent's deceptions that sin entered the world in the first place. And he has been an active enemy of God and of man ever since. He is the devil, which means accuser, slanderer. He is Satan, which means adversary or opponent. Verse 9 tells us that Satan is the deceiver of the entire world. Paul told us in 1 Timothy 2:14 that it was by deception that the world was plunged into sin. Well, that was Satan's deception. In John 8:44, Jesus said of Satan, he was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it, Jesus said. In fact, Satan's first recorded words in the Bible contain a lie. Genesis chapter 3, telling Eve, you shall not surely die. It's the opposite of what God had told her. God gave Eve a command. Satan convinced her to do the very opposite. God told Eve a fact. Satan convinced her the opposite was true. Satan's method of operation has not changed one bit. Why should he change it? It works so well. God tells us that those who believe and are baptized shall be saved. And what does Satan say? He says those who believe and are saved shall be baptized. A small twist, but a deadly one. Satan is still twisting God's word. Satan is still telling people, you shall not surely die. Satan is a deceiver. He delights in twisting the word of God. He quoted the Bible and twisted scriptures to Jesus in Matthew chapter 4. And he does the same thing today. How could a rational person read the Bible and conclude that it approves of homosexuality? How could a rational person read the Bible and conclude that baptism is not essential to salvation? Someone sent me an email recently arguing that baptism, he said, is not even part of the gospel. How can we explain such blindness? They have been blinded and deceived by Satan just as surely as Eve was blinded and deceived by Satan in the garden. Satan's methods of operation have not changed, and nor are they likely to change when they continue to work so well. And we must not be ignorant of his devices. Here's the message of these verses in a nutshell. The power behind Rome has already been defeated. Past tense. The defeat of Rome will soon follow. Rome will not fare any better than the power behind Rome, Satan. Verse 10. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. For they love not their lives even unto death. Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. We've seen language like that before. In 11, verse 5, for example, we were told the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. The statement here in verse 10 does not mark the beginning of something that just starts to happen, as if God just now suddenly started to reign and Christ just now started to have authority. It marks a public vindication of that, a public reaffirmation of those things that were already true, but now everyone knows they're true. In verse 10, we're told why they're true. Why is it that these things are now being publicly affirmed, publicly vindicated? Why is it? It's because the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. The defeat of Satan is the cause for this public vindication, this public reaffirmation of God's sovereignty. That's why it's happening here in verse 10. Verse 10 tells us something very interesting about Satan. He accuses us day and night before God. This description of Satan reminds us of the opening chapters of Job. Although there, you'll recall, it was God who first brought up Job by saying, have you considered my servant Job? You know, perhaps Satan was there accusing other people before God, and that's why God brought up Job. Okay, well, you've accused these people. Have you considered Job? Remember when as a child you had a brother or a sister who would always rush off to your parents to accuse you of something? I don't. Some of you may have had that experience. That is Satan's full-time job. Whenever you sin, you should picture Satan rushing off immediately to God to tell him, look what Eric just did. And Satan is the father of lies. And so there's no telling what lies he's telling God about you. But don't be worried, because our God is an all-knowing, righteous judge. And he knows Satan better than we do. He knows Satan is the father of lies. And we have another one there who's pleading our case for us. And the next time we're tempted to start accusing each other, we should remember this description of Satan as the accuser of our brethren, who accuses them day and night before God. That is not good company to keep. Verse 11 tells us how Satan was conquered. How did this happen? And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they love not their lives even unto death. Verse 11 is one of the key verses in this entire book. Verse 11, underline it, a key verse in the book of Revelation. Satan was figuratively defeated by this great battle in heaven. Satan was literally defeated by the blood of Christ, by the word of Christ, by the faithful proclamation of that word, by those who love not their lives even unto death. That's how it happened. We're reminded of Bonhoeffer's famous reminder. He's the preacher who was killed by the Nazis. And he wrote, when Jesus calls a man, he bids him to come and die. And we're reminded of Matthew 16:24. If any man would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. We're reminded of John 12:25. He who loves his life loses it. He who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. Verse 11 is a reminder that this book of comfort and assurance is not promising physical deliverance from Rome. God is promising spiritual deliverance from the power behind Rome. These victors were giving up their lives to this power. Satan was defeated by the death of those he was trying to kill. That doesn't sound like much of a defeat. Yes. But things are not always what they seem. How many times will we see that theme in our study of this book? Satan was defeated by the death of Christ on that cross, and he's defeated when Christ's servants follow the example of their master. The death of Jesus was a defeat, but not for Jesus. The death of Jesus was a judgment, but not of Jesus. Satan was defeated by the blood of the Lamb. It was that blood that provided the forgiveness that took the faithful forever out of the clutches of Satan. Forever out of his clutches. That's what the blood of Christ did. That was the defeat. It was that blood that made Satan's accusations of no effect. The blood of Christ. Verse 12. Rejoice then, O heaven, and you that dwell therein. But woe to you, O earth and sea, for the devil has come down to you in great wrath, because he knows that his time is short. Those who dwell in heaven are told to rejoice. Remember that God's people, even those still physically on earth, are pictured in this book as already dwelling in heaven with God. Those who dwell upon the earth always refers to the wicked in this book. The wicked who are dwelling on the earth, while God's faithful are shown as dwelling up in heaven. Why are they told to rejoice? Because their victory is assured. The Lamb has conquered Satan through his death and the power of his word. Satan could not defeat Jesus while he was on earth. Satan certainly won't be able to defeat him now that he's back in heaven. The power behind Rome was utterly and completely defeated. Past tense, at the cross. Rome is next. We've already seen the wrath of the Lamb. In verse 12, we see the wrath of the dragon. The dragon that had just been defeated by that Lamb. The difference, of course, is that the dragon's wrath is not a righteous wrath. In fact, Satan's wrath is directed here not toward those dwelling in heaven. He's been tossed out. It's now directed at his own followers, those who are dwelling on earth. Satan has no concern for their welfare. They're just tools for him to use, and they've failed him. They have failed him because he wasn't able to use that tool to defeat the church and to defeat Christ. So he's turned on them with wrath. But the text also gives us another reason for his wrath. He knows that his time is short. We're seeing here the frustration of Satan. He's been unable to destroy the church with this great deadly weapon of Rome. How could he be failing at that? The church in its infancy, Rome at its great height of power, how could he fail in trying to destroy the church with the Roman Empire? And he knows that opportunity is coming to an end. He won't be able to try that forever. He knows his time is short. Just as Satan grasped his opportunity and attempted to kill Jesus in his infancy, Satan also saw an opportunity and attempted to crush the church in its infancy. In each case, Satan failed. In each case, he was utterly defeated. Verse 13. And when the dragon saw that he'd been thrown down to earth, he pursued the woman who had borne the male child. But the woman was given two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness, to the place where she is to be nourished for a time, and times, and half a time. The serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, to sweep her away with the flood. But the earth came to the help of the woman. And the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river which the dragon had poured from his mouth. Then the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and bear testimony to Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea. The dragon sees that he's been thrown down to earth, and so he pursues the mother of the child. That is, Satan realizes his plans to defeat Jesus have backfired, and so he begins to attack Jesus' followers. If he can't reach the Lord's body in heaven, he'll attack the Lord's body, his church, on earth. Remember that persecution does not mean that God's no longer in control. God was in control at the cross. God was in control while Rome was persecuting the church. God is in control no matter what. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that happened is the will of God. Sin is clearly not the will of God. But God is in control. The woman here is given wings with which to escape the pursuing dragon. That is, the woman is protected and preserved by God. Wings are often used to symbolize God's protection. Exodus 19, verse 4, "You have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." Deuteronomy 32, 11, "Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions, the Lord alone did lead them." Psalm 36, 7, "How precious is thy steadfast love, O God! The children of men take refuge in the shadow of thy wings." Isaiah 40, verse 31, "But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength, shall mount up with wings like an eagle." The protection of God, eagles, wings, beautiful. What happens next? The dragon attempts to kill the woman with a flood, but the earth swallows the water. As with so many images in this book, this one takes us right back to Exodus. As the people of God escaped the great dragon of Egypt, God held back the water to allow his people to escape, while Moses led the Israelites across on dry ground. Elsewhere, the Bible portrays floods as threatening to engulf God's people, sometimes as a judgment by God. Isaiah 8, 7 and 8, Isaiah 43, verse 2, Psalm 144, verse 7, Psalm 32, verse 6. Well, what sort of flood had Satan unleashed on them here? It may sound kind of similar. It was a flood of delusion. It was a flood of deception. It was a flood of false religion. It was a flood of idolatry. It was a flood of false charges. It was a flood of false philosophies. It was a flood of immorality. It was a flood of compromise. It was a flood of perversion. This flood didn't work out too well for Satan. We see what happens to it. But Satan did not stop trying, did he? We're being threatened by that same flood today, the very same flood that they faced. We're not facing the same threat of physical persecution, at least not in this country. We're living, though, in a world awash in the floodwaters of Satan. Deception, false religion, immorality, perversion. The waters from that flood threaten to swallow us up, just as this flood threatened the woman. What does it mean that the earth swallowed up the flood? Isn't the earth in the enemy's camp here? Well, first, we should note that the concept of the earth swallowing up floodwaters would have been well known to John's initial readers here, as the waters would be swallowed up in the arid wilderness and in the desert. The waters, for example, flowing from Lebanon, from the mountains of Lebanon, would just disappear in the desert. It would just be absorbed by the desert and disappear. We recall what Job said to his friends in Job 6, 15 through 20. He described them as a deceitful brook that vanishes away. It just disappears beneath the sands. So this is an image they would have understood, the floodwaters being absorbed by the earth. But is that all that's involved here, or is there some symbolic meaning behind this flood being swallowed up by the earth? Is there some sense in which the earth comes to the rescue of this woman? Well, one commentator said yes. Here's what he wrote. "In the same way the earth, that is the unregenerated earthlings, the wicked, help the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing up the lies of the dragon. In doing this, the earth established a clear distinction between the world, satiated with its false religions and philosophies on the one hand, and the church clothed with truth and righteousness on the other. From the viewpoint of Satan and the world, the earth's help was incidental and unintentional. But from the viewpoint of the church, it was providential. As long as the world absorbs the river of Satan's lies and the church drinks from the fountain of divine truth, the separation between the two will remain clear and distinct, he writes. But when the woman begins to compromise with Satan and his lies, becoming submerged in his river of falsehood, tragedy follows. It's the separation of the church, that the church was so different from the world, this commentator writes. That's how the world swallowed up this flood. Recall that one reason Rome fell was because it turned on itself. We're going to see that very thing described later in this book. And Daniel told us about it 600 years before this was written. A big weakness of Rome was that it turned on itself. Remember the sequence of events here. We started off with the dragon on earth trying to devour the child. We then moved to heaven, where Satan was defeated and cast down. We're now back down on earth again. We're back down on earth, and once again we see Satan being defeated. What's the message here? God can defeat Satan anywhere Satan happens to be. That's the message. He can defeat Satan in heaven. He can defeat Satan on earth. He can defeat Satan whenever and wherever Satan happens to be. Well, what happens next? The dragon wages war against the offspring of the woman. The woman herself and her child are now beyond the reach of the dragon. That is, Jesus and the faithful people of God as a whole and pictured as already dwelling in heaven are outside of Satan's reach. They're unstoppable. They can't be defeated. However, Satan still wages war against her offspring. Who are her offspring here? I thought the church was safe up with God. I think the offspring here are the individual Christians, those literally on earth suffering persecution by Rome. I think this is the exact same division, the distinction that we saw back in chapter 11 when we saw the inner sanctuary and the court that was being trampled. Yes, some Christians at this time were physically suffering at the hands of Rome. And I think those are the offspring that are in view here, being persecuted by Rome. The promise given in Revelation that Satan will not be able to defeat the church is not new. It's not unique to this book. Recall Jesus' statement in Matthew 16, verse 18. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the powers of death shall not prevail against it. And recall Hebrews 2:14, that through death he might destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil. The New Testament is full of descriptions of this great victory. Chapter 12 ends by saying the dragon was angry with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring. Chapter 13 is going to provide the details of that attack. Chapter 13 will introduce us two new weapons that Satan would use next in his battle against the church. A beast from the sea and a beast from the earth. And as we're going to see, I believe, these beasts represent Rome, but from different perspectives. Just as we see the church from many different perspectives in this book, we also see Rome from many different perspectives in this book. Chapter 13 is going to prove to be the key to understanding the remainder of this book. And we're going to spend a lot of extra time in chapter 13. In fact, as I mentioned, I think we're going to spend an entire class on the first two verses of chapter 13. We're going to get started on right now. Chapter 13. If I had made the divisions of the chapters, chapter 13 would have actually started with the final phrase in chapter 12. So that's where I'll start reading. And he stood on the sand of the sea. And I saw a beast rising out of the sea with 10 horns and 7 heads, with 10 diadems upon its horns and blasphemous name upon its heads. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's. Its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. Who stood on the sand of the sea? That's a good question. Some say it's the dragon standing on the sand of the sea. But others say, no, the dragon went off to make war in verse 17. Some say, no, it's John standing on the sand of the sea. But verse 1 refers to John, would be referring to John then in the first person, unlike the third person referenced in verse 17. I think it most likely refers to the dragon. The dragon went off to make war, and here's where the dragon landed, stood on the sand of the sea. And John is looking at this great dragon. In verse 1, John sees a beast rise out of the sea. We've seen the sea used before to depict separation. And we've seen that sea used to depict the restless, unsettled nations of the world. I think that's what the sea means here. We see the same imagery in Isaiah 17, 12 and 13. The restless nations of the world, the restless sea. And that symbol fits perfectly. The beast represents Rome, and Rome rose from the restless nations of this world. There may be other reasons, though, behind the use of the sea here. In Isaiah 60, verse 5, the prophet compares the abundance of sea with the wealth of the nations. Jeremiah 51, 13, the prophet says that the following about Babylon, "O you who dwell by many waters, rich in treasure, your time has come." Later in verse 42 of that same chapter in Jeremiah, he writes, "The sea has come up on Babylon. She is covered with its tumultuous waves." So I think the sea here also denotes judgment. That the same Rome that came out of the sea is going to go back down into that sea. And that is what happened. This beast has seven heads with 10 horns and 10 diadems. This is the same description we were given of the dragon in chapter 12, verse 3. When we last saw the dragon, we were told that it had gone off to make war against the followers of God. And I think what we see here is one of the weapons that Satan's going to use in that conflict. This beast is both a weapon of Satan and it's a manifestation of Satan. Satan was the driving power behind this attack by Rome against the church. That beast is now wearing Satan's royal headdress. That tells us this dragon has the power, the authority given it by Satan to do Satan's work. Well, what is represented by the seven heads? That's what we're going to spend the entire next class discussing. We first saw them in chapter 12, verse 3. I mentioned that we would see them again here in chapter 13. And here they are. And their meaning is going to be explained to us in chapter 17 by an angel. And rather than wait until we get to chapter 17, I think what we're going to do is go ahead and look at chapter 17 and find out right now what these things mean. Chapter 17, verse 7 is where that starts. It contains a short commentary in which an angel explains to John the meaning of some of the things he's seen. This angel, in effect, steps outside of the vision to comment upon what John has been seeing. And what this angel tells us is crucial to understanding this book. Chapter 17 is going to begin by showing us a woman sitting upon a scarlet beast with 7 heads. 10 horns, the same symbol we saw in chapter 12, the same symbol we see here in chapter 13. We're going to see it again at the beginning of chapter 17, and the angel is going to explain it to us. What does it mean? The angel tells us in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 17, "This calls for a mind with wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain only a little while." Crucial verse, understanding so much of this book. When was this book written? That verse tells us. Who is this book all about? That verse tells us. How does this book fit in with Daniel? That verse tells us. That verse is crucial to understanding this book. That's why we're going to jump ahead a few chapters 17. Read what the angel has said and then go back to chapter 13 and figure out what's being talked about there. So what are the 7 heads? The angel actually gives us 2 answers there. The first answer he tells us is that they're mountains. They're 7 mountains. He also tells us they're 7 kings. The identification of the 7 mountains would have been immediately clear to a first century reader. One commentator says, "No reasonable doubt can be entertained as to the meaning of those words. Rome, the city that sat upon 7 hills, upon 7 mountains." This is describing Rome. Who were the 7 kings? Next week. Thank you very much for your attention.